I have a relationship with a motorcycle I don't have with a car. I feel nothing really in cars, just they're getting me where I go. You feel every inch of that engine, you know, every cubic centimetre, you can feel it alive underneath you. Some days, like, I need to talk to you. I need to express how I'm feeling through the bike. Does that sound weird?
No.
You know, and sometimes there's a rhythm to it that just works and it clicks. And you're riding through country lanes and it's like, God, I love you. I like riding by myself and then talking about it with friends. I just think you connect on such a different level.
Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, they will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right, it's going to be a good one today because our guest is a gent who has quite frankly not left our TV screens for probably, well over 30 years. He is a trusted face when it comes to consumer rights. If it's rogue traders, cowboy builders, he will sort it out for us. Of course, he's well known for being the face of Watchdog and, of course, The One Show. It is the brilliant Matt Allwright.
Hello, fellas. How's it going? All right.
Good, thank Matt. Thank you so much for joining us. And wonderfully, this is kind of hot off the press because you have just finished working today. You're joining us in your dressing room. You've been filming today, haven't you? So just get us up to speed with where you've been, what you've been up to.
So I've got a show on Channel 5, and this is the embarrassing thing. The name of the show is just my name. It's just Matt Allwright. And every day I have to go, Matt Allwright. And I don't know if you have to say your own name a lot, but it's like being at school every time you do it. And I've never got used to it, but it is lovely. It's a lovely show. It's a topical chat, politics, bit of this, bit of that. A bit of help and advice as well, because that's something that always feels kind of natural for me, is to try and sort things out for people and try and, you know, help them with the challenges that they've got every day. That seems to be my comfort zone, my natural place, you know.
And that's what we all love you for. You know, you're a trusted face on TV. Genuinely, you're a lovely fella as well. And like, I'd love it if I had a show with my own name. You know, you've made the only way you can better that is if you become like Madonna and you don't have a surname. So it just be Matt. That's what you need to aim for this time next year.
I just remember The Office. Do you remember when it's Gareth?
Yes.
And he's trying to investigate who's done what. And he comes up with different names for the session and it becomes Gareth Keenan Investigates. And I feel like that. I feel like, I think because as a journalist, you don't want to be the story. You know, you want to cover the story and you want to, it's a nice bit of defense to be talking about other people's stuff. But when you become the story yourself, I feel less comfortable with that, let's say. But, you know, it's something you quickly get used to.
It's hard work, though, isn't it? Yeah, you know, I was just about to say, you know, to do like 70 minutes of television on a daily basis, for those people who tune in and think you just rock up, there's a lot of prep. As you said, you're a journalist, you want to do a good job of it. It's hard.
And doing it every day, I've always had massive respect for anybody that has a daily show where they have to turn up and they have to, I mean, particularly we deal with callers. And you never know what people are going to say. And sometimes you come out with one assumption, you think you know what the story's about, and the British public very quickly, you know, set you straight. There's no place for, I don't know, arrogance or, you know, being pompous or any of that stuff. People won't have it. And I think it's, as much as anything, trying to get up to speed with the subjects and be on top of the brief, you know, and taking every point of view. It's later in life, it's a great thing to be doing because I feel like, you know, it's like Sudoku. It's going to hopefully stave off, you know, dementia or whatever else because you're keeping your mind active, you know.
The great thing about that, Matt, and I'm trying to discuss this between the three of us without completely alienating our listeners because we love our listeners. And of course, without you lot or watchers, we're nothing. But when we're talking about the specifics and the fundamentals of what telly is, having got into it after playing football, I've just been endlessly fascinated by it. And when it comes to production and galleries and how a studio works, and even to the kind of fundamentals of when you sat there with your earpiece in and you're listening to what's going on whilst trying to hold a conversation, that's just something that's really, really grabbed me. And it's the part of the job that just feels just the most fun, Matt, isn't it? That collaborative effort of this is all going on. And it's not necessarily a high wire thing, but my kind of feedback to people who are in the other side of it behind the camera is, well, can we all calm down? Because if it goes massively wrong, there's only person that looks like a Wally, and it's a person that's staring directly down the camera, isn't it?
And I think you're absolutely right. It's lovely being in a team. And, you know, when we were making Rogue Traders, like, these are still some of my closest friends, the people we made, because we went through a process together, and sometimes it was successful, sometimes it didn't. And win or lose, you know, you've got to look each other in the eye at the end of it and still find a way to make it work. But the most important relationship through all of that is the viewer or the listener. And I think that's always been the challenge, is whatever you're going through, whatever the process is, you know, and the scripting and the, you know, the prep, the research and the rest of it, you can easily lose the viewer and lose sight of the viewer and what they need from you. And that is always the challenge, is just to find them in the midst of all of that and say, right, keep asking yourself, what do you need from me today? What can I provide for you? That's not going to be wasting the 5 or 10 minutes that we get to share together. And that's for me, that's the bit of advice that I always try and give to people who are just starting out. It's like, never forget who your viewer is and what they ask yourself what they want.
And we're not going to forget our viewers, and we are going to get onto bikes very shortly. Otherwise, we'd have people switching off.
Oh, is that what we're here for?
Yes, we are. But before we do, just rewind the clock a little bit. Like I said at the beginning, you've been on the screens for 30 years now. So am I right in thinking, was it BBC Radio Solent, my neck of the woods? Is that where your sort of journalistic career started?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I did a course. I lived in Japan after university for 3 years. I was a teacher there. They got some bikes. And then I came back and I did a course in Portsmouth at Highbury College. And then after that, I was looking around for jobs. Solent was obviously the closest BBC outlet. So I sort of set my sights on that and spent about two and a half years there, just sort of getting up to speed. I was not good. I was not a good radio reporter. I was not a good radio presenter. I'm not a good journalist. And I was surrounded by very kind, patient people who got me up to speed properly. And that was, you know, a really important period for me, because it could have very easily all it takes is one bulletin or one broadcast for things to go wrong, really badly wrong. And having people to protect you from your mistakes, you can't guarantee that that's going to be the case. So I'm eternally grateful to all of those people. And then I had one story that actually was about my mum's tumble dryer. And she was struggling to find a new tumble dryer that would allow her to use the fabric conditioner that she used, which you might remember, it came on a sheet. Mm-hmm. And none of them would recommend it. And so I said, that sounds like a story for Watchdog. And so I wrote it and I sent it. And I followed it up with a call, and just one of those bits of luck, I got straight through to the editor of the program at the time. He read it, really liked the script I'd written, and said, why don't you come in and present it? And I've literally been there for the last 30 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And this is why with my kids, you know, when we're talking about, you know, what you can do, and it's, you know, especially when they get to end of university and these big junction points, I think the key, like you say, why would they give this to me? You know, why should I win a gold medal, right? And the answer is, why not me? Why shouldn't it be me? It's like, if you put yourself in the arena, you never know what it is you can do until you actually start sitting. For me, sitting down and writing stories, that was it. When I started to write proper scripts, it's like, oh man, I love this. I really love this. This feels so right. And I think that's why it stuck.
It's that sliding doors moment, isn't it? If you ring through and it's not the editor that you speak to, you know what I mean? It's just a different thing entirely. I mean, speaking of delving back into the past, November 2014, in an interview you did with the Northern Echo under the title of Car Talk, as in a play on the words talk, but T-O-R-Q-U-E, you asked about what your dream car was. And given what the answer is, this is why 11 and a half years later you're on this podcast with us. Your dream car, as you said, my dream car is a motorcycle. I don't really care about cars that much. People who get excited about cars haven't discovered that bikes operate in all three dimensions and are fundamentally better and much cheaper. I'd therefore be opting for an MV Augusta F4 1000R. So there you go. That's where it comes from. That's part of the journey. Where does it start before then? Are we going back to being a little one? Is there an uncle? Is there a father? Is there a grandfather? Where does it come from?
It's really bizarre. I mean, I suppose it really started with my brother and I on our bicycles. I think like all of us started on bicycles, imagining what it would feel like if you didn't have to pedal, if the power was just there straight away. And like Barry Sheen was a massive hero. In the 70s, it felt like he was a sports person. You know, when we do sports personalities of the year, right? This is no disrespect to sports people, you, and I don't want you to take this wrong, or you don't. But just sometimes they do sports personality of the year and you go, yeah, I get the sports, but where's the personality?
That's so true.
Right?
I could easily have a dig now about being runner-up to Michael Owen in that category in 1998. Well, we'll leave it there.
Don't leave that there. You know I'm a Liverpool fan. Anyway, so I just thought Barry Sheen was like, he was just so brave. The stuff he went through to get back on the bike after some of those crashes. And he was this immense character as well. And we just used to ride our bikes around the house. We used to time each other, riding our bikes around the house. And I just used to scream at the top of my voice, Barry Sheen, Mad Machine. and that was it. And it's sort of dreaming of the point where you'd actually get some power to that was, you know, I'd never thought it because my mom was so against motorcycles. My God, she was like, if you get a motorcycle, that's it. You're out of the house. Forget it. You're dead to me. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to know about that. Yeah, genuinely, she was pretty harsh about it. And so like all good sons, I waited until I was 30.
Yeah.
And genuinely, I didn't have a motorcycle for all that time because I think you just think, oh, no, that's not true. That's not true. I lie. I lived in Japan for 3 years. And during that time, I had probably my favourite motorcycle of all time, right? It was a Honda Chaley, and you'll need to Google it because it's got a it's got a basket on the front and it's a step through 50cc. And I discovered more freedom on that bike.
Just got a picture of it.
Have you got a
it's
picture?
It's so good.
Go on, Pras.
It's so good.
We'll have to flash it up.
Whether this will work, I don't know. But
oh, you have to tilt it down a bit. It's got a bit of shine on it.
I see it.
Look at that. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding. Like 2 days ago, I was in London and I saw one go past me. And obviously it's like a hipster from Shoreditch or whatever is riding this basket with a bike on it. it almost made me cry. It's almost made me cry. My best mate, we both owned it at different times and we now still refer to each other as the Chaley boys. I just call him Chaley boy and he calls me Chaley boy. So that's the power of bike.
I think that encompasses everything about biking, though. The fact that you saw one recently and you nearly cried because the nostalgia came flooding back. Like you said, the first time you'd really felt freedom, you know your parents would be against it, but it doesn't matter if it's a 50cc or a 1000cc. There's something so special about the senses being on a motorbike. And I'm assuming from what you've said already, the fact that you're a go-getter in life, you could not wait to come back to the UK and pass your bike test. I'm assuming, I know you waited till you were 30, but what was that like when you passed your bike test, that feeling?
I left Japan at 24 and then I came back and I forgot about bikes completely.
No.
And I never did it. Yeah, there's too much else going on. And plus with the lifestyle I was doing as a reporter, I needed a car. I couldn't afford both and I couldn't afford the time. Plus, you know, mum and dad. So I came back and then I was working on Watchdog and they said, look, somebody's had an idea for this show. And I'm like, okay, I'm up for it. It's an investigative show. And there was this used to be a show called House of Horrors that was presented by a mate of mine, a guy called Johnny Maitland. And it was great. They had the house all set up and plumbers used to come and roofers used to come.
Yeah.
And then they used to go and they used to go off for parts. And we were like, what happens when they go for parts? Because they've taken 3 hours. It's like, well, if we could follow them, we would know. Okay, so this was the idea on one piece of paper that when they go for parts, we follow. And anyway, it's like, well, I can't ride a motorcycle. I haven't passed my test, so I can't do it by myself. I said, well, we'll get you someone to ride a bike. And so I walk into the car park outside the BBC and there, full black leather, 6'4", is Dan, Portuguese Dan, on a Honda Blackbird. I mean, he's a courier at this stage, right? So he's riding around the streets of London. Somehow he's still alive and uninjured. He looks like a Marine commando. He's on this bike, which is, you know, a Blackbird is a big planted piece of machinery. I'm like, that's our show. That's our program right there. It's like the two of us in black leather on the one bike. I know it's Morecambe and Wise, right? But it is, it is like, why would the two of them be together? And we chase around the streets of London on this thing. We sit in Brixton waiting for plumbers to go for stuff, and we capture them on what was a little handheld camera. And it's just everything clicks. Everything clicks. He's one of the funniest guys I've ever met. Like, we get on like a house on fire. I take my bike test. I go through 125s and then direct access, as it was in those days. And I scale up, and we do this thing, this double act thing. And it just, like, you know when it's right and when it clicks. And like everything about it, at the sort of sense of humor that we had together, just spilled onto the screen. The friendship, the camaraderie that we have, just spilled onto the screen. And it just, like, the show just wrote itself. We both believed in what we were doing, and so did the rest of the team. You know,
and I suppose the moment when it comes to the essence of what biking is, and you say that specific look that you saw of working out what a show is, suddenly being shown what a show is with something that kind of evocative. And then obviously being in the position where you're tearing around London on a bike. Does that then, given what you said about being in Japan and then getting a bit older to do your test, would you look at, this is a long-winded way of me asking you a question, but how you actually look at bikes and what biking is, because we speak to all different kinds of people on the podcast, and it's just an utter joy. And some, you know, I mean, it comes out of their every pore. The minute you ask them about bikes, they look quite whimsical and look far off into the distance. Whereas it feels like it's been factored into a big part of what your working life is and what your working life has afforded you, which is the ability to work in telly and make programs and be in the position that you are in now. So can you separate the two? Is one a passion and one a purpose?
It's all the same. All the same. And the bike is so many things. But I think what the bike used to say to the viewer was, we're taking a risk on your behalf.
Yeah.
That's it. Because we all know that bikes are inherently risky. Mm-hmm. All right. We're not kidding anybody. We know the risks we take when we get on a bike. And we know we have to be focused. We have to concentrate. And we all tell our wives and our partners and our mums and dads, it's fine, I know what I'm doing. And the reality is, we know it's not safe. Mm. All right. And we are prepared to take that on board. But when you're doing that, this is what I loved about it. When you're doing that for Rogue Traders, it's like, this is the only way that we can do this, that we can track these guys down and see what they're really doing. So we're going to use this as a tool. We're going to take a risk on your behalf. We're not just going to sit safely in a studio and tell stories. We're actually going to, take risks and go. I mean, God, some of the places we went. Genuinely, I remember there was like a gang of fly tippers operating in Gravesend in Kent. And we found their sort of illegal incineration site. And we parked the bike up and we're walking there. We're both in full race leathers. I mean, it's just insane. It's a like blazing hot day. And we wander onto the site and there's like, we're miles away from the bike. And there's piles of burning rubbish all around us, and we're filming everything that we see. There's like mattresses going up, like asbestos, all sorts of dangerous stuff. And then we hear the sound of big dogs barking. and so we keep the cameras running. We just run away. We run away like complete chickens. But it was like, that was the point. It's like, we are going to go and put ourselves in dangerous places with people that you wouldn't like to meet, because that's the privilege we've been given, is to pursue these stories on your behalf. So we're going to use it and we're going to take risks. And the bike is emblematic of that, because it's in itself maverick and risky. So and I love that, man. I love being part of that culture.
How on earth do you replace that buzz? Because you've mentioned a number of things that got my hair stood up there, in terms of, obviously, we all know live television, we've all done it, and that's a bit of a thrill, the risk element, things can go wrong. But like you said, you're on a bike, that's dangerous. You're going tearing through London where the traffic is crazy. You're going after baddies, you're about to expose baddies and they can catch you. I mean, that to me sounds like the dream adrenaline junkie's job. That's TV right there.
Yeah, well, it really was. And afterwards, there would be times when we'd stop and as a team, we'd sit for some reason, always in Frankie and Benny's. I don't know how it ended up, but we'd always end up on a retail park somewhere, and it was always a Frankie and Benny's. We'd sit down there, and we'd go, "What just happened? What did we just do?" Do you know what I mean? And it must be. It's like a sporting or a musical performance. I genuinely think that when you've done something, you go. This is when they talk about the zone. It's like, I don't know how that happened. I know we made part of it happen, but so much of it was up to chance. And we'd sit down as a group and just go, nothing beats that. Nothing beats the feel that we've made that all happen together, you know, and we get to show people as well. We get to put it on the telly and we'll laugh about it all over again, you know.
I suppose it's like living inside a real life Guy Ritchie film, isn't it? When you hear the dogs and people say fights and stuff at Crow's End.
That's possibly closer to the truth than you realise. I could honestly, so many times we really look back and go, I'm not quite sure how we got away with that. I'm not sure we'd be allowed to do it now.
Yeah. The look on your face, Matt, says it all. It's some things we can keep to ourselves, can't we? Anyway, quick bit of mid-show housekeeping, folks. If you haven't already, please press the subscribe button on YouTube so you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
We talked to lots of guests, Matt, and hopefully, like yourself, famous faces. We talk to people and a lot of things they all say they've got in common. One of the love of bikes is that freedom, the fact that you can pull the visor down like you were doing on Rogue Traders, hopefully not get spotted. And there's something very special, isn't there? If you are someone who's going to go into B&Q or wherever it is, and people are going to not bother you but recognize you, there's something special about being on a bike, isn't there? Just be able to be you and have a bit of you time. You live a very, very busy life. But we're on that bike, it's just you and the bike, and that's magical.
Yeah, it really is. And I think it is the focus as well that you have to give it. And you probably know this as well. You can feel it. You can tell the days when you're really in sync with the bike. And I think it must be like riding a horse. I think that's, that again, part of the attraction, because it feels like you have a relationship. I have a relationship with a motorcycle I don't have with a car. I feel nothing really in cars, just they're getting me where I go. But it's like some days, like I need to talk to you. I need to express how I'm feeling through the bike. Does that sound weird?
No.
You know,
no.
And sometimes there's a rhythm to it that just works and it clicks. And you're riding through country lanes and it's like, God, I love you. It's like how, you know, and you know, little things about the way bikes work, which are kind of counterintuitive as well. It's like counter steering, like leaning the bike in and turning the handlebars the wrong way. It's like that's a kind of an organic thing that every bike does slightly differently, and that the sound of the engine, the vibration you get through the engine, it's like you're not going to get that from a car. It's so much closer to a living thing, you know, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I just think you connect on such a different level.
That is such an amazing way of describing it, Matt, because there'd be an old school cliche of what motorcycling and biking is, which would be rebellion, wouldn't it, and breaking free and not caring. But what you've described there is almost the kind of antithesis of that. It's about feeling something extremely deeply and for yourself, and not necessarily getting away from anywhere, but getting more in touch with yourself, which is such a wonderfully poetic way of talking about that thing that we park up and stare at, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's about also the connection with nature is a lot closer as well. And again, you're taking a risk to be much closer, you're more exposed. So wind feels real, speed feels real. I remember I was riding my bike along just not far from home, and I was kind of aware of this, like a projectile. And I'm like, what the hell is that? And it sort of got closer and got faster and faster as it got closer. And it went bang right in the front of my helmet. And it was a pigeon. And but I spotted it from miles off, and it nearly knocked me backwards off the bike.
Yeah.
That was probably the you know, but you can, like, riding through fords, it is just like it's like what the Wild West stuff. It really is. You feel part of it, not that you're isolated from it as you are, you know, in other vehicles maybe.
It's, yeah, I said the word magical earlier, but it really is. I remember one of our earliest episodes, we had the brilliant Chris Akabusi on, and he just went off on one about what biking meant to him.
He generally did.
Yeah, we generally did, but he just summed it up. He was talking about the smell of flowers going past, and it was just amazing. But in terms of where you're at with your love affair with bikes at the moment, we saw where it started, the bike in Japan, the little 50cc. What's your bike of choice at the moment? I'm assuming you've had lots of wonderful bikes over the years.
Well, to be honest, I kind of settled very early. I've had the same bike now for a long time. It's my only bike. So I'll take you right the way through. First bike was a Kajiva Planet 125. Looks like a Ducati Monster, but like it's been in the wash and shrunk.
Yeah.
And I think it was two-stroke, had this ring-a-ding-ding engine, somehow managed to go 70 miles an hour. It was joyous and yellow, and like then I had to trade. Then I had a little Varadero as well that we used for the show as well, the 125 Varadero. And then where do I go from that? Then I had a CBR 600, which was could go faster than I'd ever need to go. I'm not a massive speed freak. It's not a big thing for me. So did that. Then I had a 900 SS Ducati. That's the most physical feeling bike I've ever had. You know, so vibey, dry clutch. The noises, there was like, it's like you got and started it up. It was like Keith Moon was in your back pocket. It was, you know, it was like the drums and cymbals were going off. Great, but hard work. And then I sold that to get what I've got now, which is that I think the only bike I'll... I don't really feel like I need any other bikes now. I've got a KTM 990 Adventure.
Very nice.
The Stealth Bomber. It's just so distinctive. No other bike looks like it. I love the fact that it's a litre bike, but it's thin, it's narrow because the V-twin sits that way. Again, it starts up and you feel every inch of that engine, you know, every cubic centimetre, you can feel it alive underneath you. And I love the riding position. I love the fact that in theory I could go off-road. In theory. And then I'd have to... Then I'd have to get friends to help me pick it up afterwards. So, you know, if it fell over. But I, you know, it's just a bike that I've really enjoyed. I don't need a lot of speed. I think with big tall bikes, you feel kilometers for miles an hour. So you don't need to go fast because you can feel everything. You can feel the wind. If it was a sports bike, you know, you break the speed limit before you really feel the speed that you're going. So for me, that just feels like a more, you know, I don't know. It feels like you're experiencing more on that kind of a bike. And I think that it feels like sports bikes are not in that moment in the way they were maybe 20 years ago. So a lot of people feeling that as well, maybe. I don't know.
I think as well, I mean, that broadening out of what biking's become from an accessible point of view, you're absolutely right, Matt, because it is... It's what suits you, what feels right on you. And I think it feels to me like the party's open to more people than it ever really has been, even though that's possibly in direct relation to how tough it is to get your license nowadays, to get up on that ladder of being able to enjoy motorcycling. But have you managed to, with all these years that we're talking about of riding and being out there, do you manage to kind of pass that forward in the sense of, is it quite easy for you to meet a biker and strike up that conversation? Because obviously we are the best dinner party guests, aren't we?
Yeah, I like riding by myself and then talking about it with friends. I find
such a good way of putting it.
I find the group riding thing is not for me so much, because that's not the point of the kind of glory of making your mind up by yourself. And I've got loads of good friends who are also bikers, but I don't ring anybody up and say, let's go for a buzz, because I like to set my own speed, my own itinerary. You know, it makes me sound really antisocial. But like, I'll see you when you get there and then we'll have a chat. So that really works. And I've got, you know, Chailey Boy is like my best friend in the world, and it was the love of a 50cc bike that kind of brought us together in the first place, and we continue to love bikes. And he's like, typically I'm a KTM guy, he's a BMW guy, right. So
you obviously can't hang out together. That's
no, can't possibly.
Matt, it's such a good point, because it's that is what you've described there is akin to what my heart's like when it comes to biking. I do have mates that have bikes, and there is that kind, and it's that's absolutely blown my mind that you said that sense of, well, we might have all have bikes, but can I just meet you when I get there? Is that all right? No offense to how you ride, what you do, what you're on at all. Go to your own party there. But that sense of, right, what have I got? Got my bike, got my keys, got my bag. Done. Right, I'm ready. Let's go. Yeah. I'm not checking in my wing mirror going, what's he doing now? Are we stopping? It's that sense of this is my own volition.
Yeah, I also think that it makes it even more impressive when you see like big groups of bikers together, like the rides for Dave Myers, and you see that because you've basically got like thousands of individuals who, you know, they are independent minded people who like to do things their own way, because that kind of defines bikers, and they all agree that Dave Myers was a legend and that something needs to be done to recognize who he is on behalf of, you know, his family, him, but also bikers, to recognize that was a true spirit, you know. So it does make it's such a sight to see when bikers come out in force.
It brings good people together, doesn't it? Now, in terms of, you said the KTM, you've actually said it's probably going to be your final bike because you love it. Why would you get rid of it? I was going to ask you, is there no itch that needs to be scratched, like the Augusta?
Michelle.
Well, you know, you said when you were a kid that, you know, the MV Augusta F4 was your dream bike, and you haven't had one of them, surely. You're still to be got or not? No
need for speed. I've got no, it's not the, I love the freedom it gives you and the opportunity for getting places. But you know, if I was on a, you know, Honda C90, then I'd still be happy, if as long as it gets you there and it gets you there in that way. But is there a bike I would love? I mean, if I lived in a different country, maybe. I think I've always loved the Fat Boy. I've always loved that closed,
iconic, in it, yeah.
Front wheel. It's like if you're going through the Salt Lakes of Utah, you don't want to be on a cake. You want to be on a Fat Boy. You want to go straight, and you want to hear that sound. And I've done that from time to time, but not for this country. There's no point. Sitting there, you get home and you just have to clean all that chrome. Do you know what I mean? It's not, that's not what I got into biking for. I don't get into biking for household chores. I do it, it's because it liberates me. It doesn't have to tie me down. So I love a big fat Harley in the right circumstances is great. I would love to think I'd have a proper off-road stab, like a 250, like KTM 250, but I think my back would say otherwise these days, you know. So no, I'm really happy with what I've got.
You sound very content with what you have, which is a lovely way to live life. And as you said, you've got two wheels, it gets you from where you need to be on your own, and you've got a smile in your face getting there. So it sounds like you're winning.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think I'd change it for the world, to be honest. I know there've been upgrades since, and KTM have made some beautiful models, but I'm okay. Yeah.
I like that. A contented biker, Ewan, especially when it comes to bike choice. That may be a first on the podcast. Yeah, right, we've got now, Matt. Seeing as though you've been working very hard today, we're going to work you a little bit more, my friend, unfortunately. Okay. We've got a quick fire round of questions, all very lighthearted, of course.
There's no right or wrong answer. Don't worry.
Oh, God, now I'm worried.
We're still trying to work out what the winner of this gets, other than our full respect over the course of a series. So I'm going to fire some questions at you. Well, we both have, between myself and Ewan. Just quick fire answers, 60 seconds, answer as many as you can. And as I said, just enjoy it.
Okay.
So, Matt, all right, if you're sitting comfortably, I'm going to get the stopwatch out, and then Ewan's going to begin with the first question. Really? And then we're up and running, sunshine, aren't we? Right, Ewan, 3, 2, 1, go.
Who was your motorcycling hero growing up?
Barry Sheen.
What posters did you have on your bedroom wall, Matt?
Oh, the Smiths.
Nice.
Italian bikes or British bikes?
Italian bikes.
Who's your favourite Spice Girl?
Ginger.
Chocolate or crisps?
Crisps.
In Watchdog the movie, who plays you?
God. Steve Edge.
Okay, right. American bikes or Japanese bikes?
Japanese bikes.
Indian or Chinese for takeaway?
Chinese, every time.
This will be a good one. Favourite album of all time?
Oh, Giant by the Wooden Tops, 1986.
What's your favourite animal?
A black miniature schnauzer.
What's the best thing about live telly?
When it ends.
Norton or Triumph?
Triumph.
Time's up. Time's up. Time's up.
Man, I wanted to go in so much more detail about all of those.
Okay. Well, the next one was pretty boring. What's the square root of 16? So yeah, you missed
that. That's four. That's four. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's just showing off, though, isn't it? No one likes a smart.
No. more than happy to have smarts on here, because it helps put myself and you into sharp focus. You got 12, mate. So well done.
12. 12 is a good score.
I mean, there was no right answer though, right? So it's just the speed of which
just
you
just how quick you are.
You rattled through it. You may not want to ride your motorbike fast, but you get through the questions quickly. Yeah.
There's so many that I would revisit on that and give more detail on. That's the only thing I would say. Like British bikes, like Triumphs. I could definitely have a Triumph.
If it's detail you want, then Ewan's got a question for you where you can fill your boots with as much detail as you like.
Okay.
I certainly have. Right, man. This is final question time, and this is a lovely one. You can go away into your mind and come away with a beautiful answer. So we want your most idyllic ride, your fantasy ride. So you could be riding anywhere in the world. You could be on any bike that you choose. I think you're going to be solo, but you can have someone with you if you want. And what would be your soundtrack? So where are you going? On what bike? With what company and with what music in your ears, if any?
Right. I would go back to Japan and I would go with my best mate, Chaley Boy, and we'd have a pair of Chaleys.
That's going to be a long road trip.
And we would ride the road over Mount Buko, which takes you into the city of Chichibu, because we did that a lot of times, but we did it. We didn't both have Chaleys. There was only one Chaley. I would get us both Chaleys and we'd stop at the top. And at the top of this mountain, there is a vending machine which sells hot milk chocolate drink, right? And we both stop and we'd have one of those and then we'd ride the Chaleys down into Chichibu, to which neither of us has ever been back, right? Because we were both there at the time. And we would stop and we would drink Asahi from giant cans in a tatami matted flat. And we would laugh and laugh and laugh about the times we spent together. And that is the power of bikes. You get to meet the best people and you have friendships that last forever and you just laugh and laugh and laugh. Am I allowed that?
You're more than allowed that. That's I've never been there, but I was daydreaming of being there with you. That sounded so good.
Absolutely.
And there was no mention of music. I'm assuming you don't need any soundtrack. The 50cc is your soundtrack.
We differ very, very greatly on music, me and Chaley Boy. He would probably have Queen or Dire Straits or Def Leppard. And I would probably have something miserable like the Smiths or the Specials or something like that. So maybe we just have the sound of the wind in our ears. And we've got Bluetooth link up. So that's it. We're just
chattering all the way along.
And we would never get over 30 miles an hour. We might not even make it up the mountain. I don't know.
That's all I could think about, props, was the fact that these little 50Cs working their heart out to get up the mountain. But that's one of the most detailed answers I think we've ever had. I could even smell the chocolate from the chocolate machine when you mentioned the hot chocolate. Genuinely, I was, you took me there. I reckon that's my favourite fantasy ride, genuinely, ever.
I was very much on the same page as that, Ewan, because I was lost for a minute then. Properly lost. I was questioning everything, man.
Ewan
and I,
so Chaley,
should we go?
Yeah, I was questioning my life choices then. I was thinking, I've never been there. I want to be Matt's mate. Why can't I go? I loved it.
That's it. We're brothers in bike now. So all we've got to do is find someone to pay for our tickets. And it's a great TV show. Let's face facts.
We can spitball that together. Well, sadly, Matt, I mean, that's about it for this week's full chat, which is, of course, powered by Bikeshaw, the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. The lovely people at Bikeshaw will tell you your exact needs and help you save money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance, and so much more.
Genuinely, that is one of my favorite episodes. You've taken me to a wonderful place in my mind. A huge thank you to today's guest, the brilliant Matt Allwright.
Thank you so much, guys. I loved that.
It's been wonderful. Really appreciate you joining us for a Biker's Blather. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
As ever, thank you very much for everyone who's listened. I'm sure you've enjoyed it as much as we have. Until next time, goodbye.